That simple, I didn't do it. Okay.
That's it.
It's comforting though, all you have to do is. It's like when you come on a retreat. One time my teacher Joseph said to me, my mind was in, so it was a long retreat, my mind was in some construction about, you know, how really to do the practice in the way that was just for me, and I was, you know, that I thought would be the best support, and I don't know, I was presenting it to him, and he said, all you have to do is sit and walk. With very, you know, just with this sort of clear, wise, simple, also, but it also felt very compassionate, because it allowed me to really drop into paying attention to, in this case, as I said, it was a long retreat, just paying attention to kind of the natural flow of, you know, how long was the sitting going to last? I didn't know. And so when I gave up on some of the schedule, it just sat down, just there was just a flow of sitting, and then, okay, now it's time to walk. There was a great paradoxical balance of fitting into or aligning with the form, and also listening to the flow, really, of aliveness that isn't really the form, but it's not the form either. You know, this is the paradox of practice. So today I actually wanted to talk about courage and walking through the door, of perhaps a different way of being with ourselves. Or maybe, you know, some of us who've practiced quite a bit, we might say, well, it's not really a different way, you know, I have a consistent practice, that's wonderful, truly. And I know for myself, with sort of many years practice, it's quite humbling to come up against what I would say is the conditioned mind, the conditioned habit of thinking, relating to self, to other, to the world. So I thought today we could hear a bit about some of the Buddhist teachings on the path of practice, and also how we can apply that, and how it can support us in our moment-to-moment experience. So the Buddha, I like to think of the Buddha as a, I know this is rather overly simplistic, but it was someone who was a kind of a rarefied cognitive scientist. And if you think of it, you know, no, I won't go over the story, but so many of us have probably read Siddhartha or have some sense of the Buddha's journey. I mean, it deserves a lengthy story, but that won't be for now. There was this great human desire for peace, for freedom. You know, as we know, he grew up in the 1% and was protected. His parents wanted him to be a king and wanted to, perhaps as many parents do, want to protect their children from pain and sorrow and suffering. And they might have gone to some extremes in terms of keeping him protected from the rest of the 99% of the population, but keeping him around pleasant, as much pleasantry as possible, as much beauty and goodness. And, you know, I mean, these stories have been carried down for centuries, so whether or not they're actual truth or they're metaphors, I personally don't get too caught up in that, because I like to listen in for what's useful, just what is actually useful in my own practice. So the story of, it always seems to stick with me, is where the Buddha's father would have the gardener go out at night and clip off the dead flowers so the Buddha would just see the beautiful flowers. Something that was so visceral about that in terms of that grasping for beauty and pleasure and no pain, no sorrow, no loss. And as we all know, it's completely impossible. And when the Buddha started to seek out past his personal home, was awakened by seeing illness, death, poverty, and practicing monastic who looked very peaceful in the face of that. So in continuing on as this cognitive scientist began to explore through his own practices and working with his mind and heart to really see, well, what brings about liberation? How could this be possible? How could that person be at peace in the midst of this difficulty? So we might have, 2,600 years later, some of the same questions. How is it possible to be at peace in our own hearts and minds when perhaps we're dealing with some difficult personal circumstances of loss or suffering or worldly circumstances that seem to be unavoidable and increasing in terms of, like, say, things like the climate challenge, the Buddha talked a lot about greed, hatred, and delusion, and how those qualities of mind lead to great suffering. So we could easily say there's some rampant greed, hatred, and delusion across the world, but in Western culture, in terms of this deluded idea that if we gain more, get more, produce more, accumulate more, become something, that that's going to protect us from pain. And it certainly can get played out into some very horrifying circumstances where you and me and us and them and othering creates horrific pain and suffering. So I think a lot about this in the worldly life. I think a lot about these Buddhist teachings, when I read the news. I've been involved in spiritual practice since I was 18, so it's a bunch of decades there. And I just feel so, both so grateful and also so compelled right now to continue to practice and to share that and to commune with others who are practicing. And I must say, I've trained in Buddhism for many, many years, but I don't even mean just Buddhist practice. I mean, some of us have other spiritual practices or practices of love and liberation. It just seems that the world is crying for some wisdom and love. And thinking of a quote by Joanna Macy, she said, I practice so I won't harm other people. So I won't cause harm to other people. So it's very beautiful. I'm going to read you a quote. Some of you might be familiar with David White. It's an English poet. This is not a poem of his, it's a quote. It's a quote about vulnerability. It's a word I find myself saying a lot, using a lot, reflecting on a lot. So he says this: vulnerability is not a weakness, a passing indisposition, or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, and abiding undercurrent of our natural state. To run from vulnerability is to run from the essence of our nature. The attempt to be invulnerable is the vain attempt to become something we are not. And most especially, to close off our understanding of the grief of others. More seriously, in refusing our vulnerability, we refuse the help needed at every turn of our existence and immobilize the essential tidal and conversational foundations of our identity. To have a temporary isolated sense of power over all events and circumstances is a lovely, illusionary privilege, and perhaps the prime and most beautiful constructed conceit of being human, and especially of being youthfully human. But it is a privilege that must, I'm not sure I totally agree with that, but it's for later reflection, but it is a privilege that must be surrendered with that same youth, with ill health, with accident, with the loss of loved ones who do not share our untouchable powers, powers eventually and most emphatically given up as we approach our last breath. He says, the only choice we have as we mature is how we inhabit our vulnerability, how we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance. Our choice is to inhabit vulnerability as generous citizens of loss, robustly and fully, or conversely, as misers and complainers, reluctant and fearful, always at the gates of existence, but never bravely and completely attempting to enter, never wanting to risk ourselves, never walking fully through the door. Quite an invitation, isn't it? It's quite an invitation to meet vulnerability. So I was thinking of meeting with all of you in this form of offering a talk. I just kept thinking of courage, of everyone's courage. I don't know you personally, but I feel it just sitting in the room with you. You know, the courage to be here, you know, the courage to sit. Sit with yourself, sit with your own mind and heart, sit with others. You may not realize it in the moment, because sometimes we just get pulled, you know, into the whatever we're facing, the difficulties of what we're facing, or not wanting what we don't want, you know, or wanting our sitting to be different, our mind to be different. We forget in those moments when we're pulled in that way, how much just our presence here and our willingness to be here and to engage in the practice is a profound gift. A profound gift, not just to ourselves, but to everyone in this room, Daryl and myself included. We would get really bored if we were just here by ourselves. But truly, it's such an inspiration, and it's like the visceral, you know, when you know, in this role of preparing for a talk, you know, it's like a what feels inspiring. And that's the first thing, truly, that came to me, is the courage of each of you and how deeply inspiring and enlivening that is to me. We forget it about ourselves, though. It's interesting. You know, I know I'm generalizing, but I think it's probably a fair generalization that we tend, in this Western culture, to go after ourselves, you know, even in spiritual practice, like, should I do it this way, should I do it that way? You know, I'm not suggesting that then don't ask any questions or don't make use of, you know, consulting with a teacher, because it is helpful to see where we can get, as I was speaking about today in the instruction I was giving, is where we can kind of get, for some of us, we may err on the side of striving more and clamping down, and just you can feel it. You can feel it in your body and in your mind. Just trying so hard, you start to get a headache, you know. Or you might notice, like, I don't really want to be there, and kind of, you know, spacing out. And be careful about what I'm saying here, because often in the first day, and unless, and some people sort of run more on the side of having a lot of energy and feeling some agitation, but for most people, the first day, if you think of you're switching out of your busy lives, there's a lot of tiredness. So I wouldn't misunderstand tiredness as somehow you're being lethargic or unwilling. Sometimes we just have to bring our attention to that tiredness and be patient and be kind. It's natural for human beings. You know, we're slowing down. The body recognizes slowing down as it's time to go to sleep. We're shifting into another kind of gear of paying attention and living. So in this quote about that David White speaks about vulnerability, I connect that with the gift and the beauty of the Buddha's teachings that, you know, he offered so, you know, several thousand years ago. They seem so applicable today. You know, that the Buddha, in this cognitive scientist role, really basically reviewed the unfolding steps, you know, that what he looked back on, well, what was it that led this mind and heart to liberation? What opened, you know, what was the path? So the Buddha, at that time, in a great inspiration of compassion, upon his awakening, realized this is something to share. This is some, not from an ego place, I have it, but just out of really the beautiful heart of compassion, that wanting, you know, he said, you know, if I could come to this awareness and this awakening, and I'm a human being, then others can. And so here we are, you know, that this many thousands of years later, where these teachings have been passed on. So one of the things that in his cognitive scientific way of just paying attention to the mind, you know, and Daryl was speaking to this in the instructions this morning, you know, as we slow down, pay attention to our minds, pay attention to the breath, you know, life reveals itself, like it or not. I mean, we get to see more clearly. It doesn't feel that way in the moment. Sometimes it feels like it's all over the place and we can feel very fuzzy, or you know, counter to that, we might have an insight arises, or something, a clear understanding, and, you know, that's, you know, enlivening, and then we think, okay, now I've got it. You know, the rest of the practice is just going to be this uphill, you know, beautiful realm. And then you come back in the next sitting and you feel tired, or all of a sudden you have a kind of a thought storm of greed, hatred, and delusion. What happened? What did I do wrong? I love that question. What did I do wrong? How can I get it back to, you know, this way? It's natural that we want to feel good. It's natural. But the Buddha taught about this, said that that's actually one of the characteristics, one of the three characteristics of life, that as we practice, we begin to see more clearly, is this suffering nature of mind. It's the English translation, the English translation is suffering. It also could be talked about as the dissatisfied mind. Essentially, it's just seeing that the nature of mind react to the comings and goings, the ups and downs of just being alive, just living life. So the tendency of the mind is to want to get away from what is unpleasant and difficult. Okay, that isn't anything to criticize. That's the tendency of the conditioned mind. And so, but what often happens without us seeing that clearly, we become lost in the belief somehow, even if it's not a conscious belief, it's a running belief, that if we just get rid of this particular situation or circumstance, or if it will just be gone, then we'll be okay. Then life will be okay. And it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to reflect just a little bit on that and realize, wow, actually it's not possible. It's not possible to get rid of what's painful. And equally so, it's not possible to commodify what's pleasant. I mean, yet we try. we will be drawn towards what's pleasant. And when it goes away, again, that sense of self or identity can come in and say, okay, what happened? How can I get it back? Or what did I do that it went away? And it's missing the wise insight that pleasure and pain comes and goes. So we know this. I mean, we know this intellectually. I'm not speaking to the intellect. As a matter of fact, the Buddha said, it is not, you know, liberation is not going to come through the intellectual mind, through that conditioned mind. It's actually going to come through a kind of a paradoxical surrender and application. So we're surrendering to, it's just like this. It's just like this. And the application is really bringing our attention. So it's not, it's just like this, forget it, I give up. No, it's just like this, can I be interested in it? Can I be curious in it? Can I open to it? And it's interesting, here's David White saying, you know, speaking to how much we get lost in staying away from that, really, and trying to control our lives when it's actually complete delusion that we can. So again, here comes the circle of reflecting on one's courage. It takes a lot, in a way, to open to that that vulnerability of things changing, things coming and going. You know, not based on our control, but based on life. So there's beauty in that too. There's really. I was walking earlier down by the river, and or maybe it was the path a little bit in between the river and up here, there's layers there. And all of a sudden, I saw this little chickadee, and the next thing I knew, it just like flew right into me. It just kind of like bumped up against me, and I could feel its beating heart. And it was something so mysterious about it. I don't know why that happened. Well, I started to, you know, how you can kind of imagine things like, oh, I wonder if they feed the chickadees here. Because any of you have been to IMS or maybe other places where it's kind of a practice to feed the birds, you just walk outside and they start to fly towards you. Like, where's the sunflower seeds? But, I did go through, I wonder why that happened. But really, it was kind of a mystery. And it was this beautiful moment, really, of connection with this creature. So, you know, we can miss those little things sometimes when we're busy in our minds and our doing minds. That was such a beautiful invitation that Daryl offered earlier today to take time to connect and reflect and feel, really. Not just think about it, but just feel that living connection with nature, with the trees, with the birds, with the air. Anthony DeMello said, some of you may be familiar with Anthony DeMello. He's deceased now. He was a radical Catholic, very radical Catholic sage. He wasn't super well respected by the more traditional Catholic hierarchy. A beautiful teacher. He described enlightenment as this: enlightenment is the absolute and wholehearted acceptance of the inevitable. The absolute and wholehearted acceptance of the inevitable. And the cooperation, wholehearted, the absolute and wholehearted cooperation and acceptance of the inevitable. He said something else too. He said many things. But I wrote this other quote down. He said, "It's a great mystery that through the that though the human heart longs for truth, in which alone it finds liberation and delight, the first reaction of human beings to truth is one of hostility and fear." Let's see a few nods out there. Isn't that fascinating? Really? I mean, we long for this freedom, if you will. I'll just use some words. Freedom, liberation, peace. We long for it. We have these beautiful, and they seem so simple, these instructions that are, you know, passed along. And yet, it's so interesting just to watch the mind like, no, no, no. And it's an interesting place of practice to kind of hover around that. Like, maybe not sort of necessarily, if you understand what I'm saying, sort of give in to the fleeing into the doing. Even if the doing's like, I'm gonna walk my meditation walk this way, or I'm gonna do this for my sitting practice, you can tell even in the tone. That's always helpful to notice the tone when it's like, I'm gonna get it down, I'm gonna get it right. That's a different quality than this. It has a perseverance in it, but it has an openness, a quality of surrendering. It's like showing up and surrendering, showing up and surrendering, showing up and surrendering. Is this making sense, what I'm saying? You know, because I'm using words here, but I'm pointing to something that it's very powerful in practice, and it's subtle. And if we can start to see it, we can start to see, like, what is the machinations of mind here? And can we just open to this moment, whatever it is? Like, you might notice the breath, it might be a sound, maybe you're noticing thinking, you're noticing longing. Can we just be present with it? And then even notice the commentary about it, because it will come, it will be there. It's like the Muzak, you know, when you go to the dentist's office, it's in the background. The commentary will be there. And when we can notice that we're lost in the commentary, it's like, okay, when we notice we're lost in it, we're no longer lost. We can come out and just come back to this present moment. It's why the Buddha talked about it as practice and training, because it's almost like you find yourself, it's skill building, really, where the more that we can actually bring that attention to just being present and perhaps not be so entranced by the thoughts about what's happening, because they will show up. If we can not actually get so entranced by the pull of it, then we're really hovering in that place of vulnerability, that place of presence, that it's not even a place, but that energy, that field. And there's that capacity, really, for freedom is right in that moment. Right in that moment. Somebody today was asking about, or speaking to, and asking about compassion. There's a quote, Nisargadatta, some of you may be familiar with his quotes, kind of a famous quote, that wisdom tells me I'm nothing, love tells me I'm everything, and in between, my life flows. So the wisdom factor is this characteristic that the Buddha talked about, this third characteristic of this illusion of a separate self, this illusion that that we do have control, that we're separate from each other. And in a conventional way, of course we are. You know, we each have our own personalities, our names, our lives, our individual lives. I mean, that doesn't disappear when we practice. It's part of our lives. But as we investigate into this mind of sense of separation or sense of control, we begin to kind of see its illusoriness. Like, for instance, if you're sitting in meditation and you're noticing sound is coming, or you're you're feeling the movement of your breath. And you begin to notice how it's changing. You know, meaning awareness will notice different things at different times, whatever calls your attention. You might even begin to notice that about thought. As we practice more, the mind settles more. Even if the mind is active, awareness notices thought, like it might notice a sound coming and going, or sensation coming and going. The thought comes and then it goes. And it's really interesting to pay attention to. And as we begin to see those thoughts coming and going, that grip of this is me, like I am my thought, I am what I think about, that also starts to loosen. And we just begin to see it is all coming and going. That sense of me, my, and mine starts to get loosen up. And at times, this can be a very liberating experience, so to speak. An experience. It's rather than a thought. It's that direct experience of it. And sometimes it can be very frightening, too. It's unfamiliar. We're not familiar with it. So then we can just bring our attention to that fear as it arises. What's born, which I think Nisargadatta was saying in this quote, in between my life flows. So the wisdom factor is seeing that empty nature, if you will, of this sense of self. But the love factor is really seeing our interconnectedness. That when we begin to really meet our experience that directly and that openly, it's just natural that the understanding becomes pretty clear that, well, if that's happening for me, it's happening for everyone else. You know, that I'm in this flow of life that we call human, and our hearts begin to open quite naturally. It's non-intellectual. It's an evolution of presence, of practicing presence, if you will, like training our minds and hearts to come back again to this present moment. Because it can get pretty boring, you know? It can get pretty boring, or we're looking for the fruit, you know, we're looking for the result, or we start to get into that selfing of, I'm not doing it right, or should I do this practice or that practice? And doubt arises, and we can get pretty despairing. So that might be a perfect time to reflect on, wow, if this is happening in my mind, this suffering in my mind, here, now, in this meditation, sitting in this moment, chances are it's happening for someone else in this room. Maybe plenty of people beyond this room. And we start to open to that shared humanity. So what happens when we open to that shared humanity? What's possible? Because it's not just a here in a meditation retreat. You know, we're not just practicing to do well on a meditation retreat. It's really, how do we meet our lives? How do we relate to our own experience in our life? Whether it's we may be in the midst of incredible grief or loss. How do we meet that? Can we meet it with a tenderness towards ourselves? Compassion, care. It's different than self-pity. Pity is considered the near enemy of compassion. You know, in another way that I think we meet our sorrows is being with others. You know, coming together on retreat or being with others in our lives that hopefully can support this recognition, if you will, of vulnerability. Sometimes it's just so freeing, isn't it, when someone just shares from their heart. It's comforting. It's permissive. these three characteristics that the Buddha talked about, the understanding, suffering, that it's part of our human conditional reality, and seeing the impermanent nature of things coming and going. I have this little joke that I tell. My mom is 93, and she still lives in the house that I grew up in. So I'm in my early 60s. She moved into that house when my elder brother, she was pregnant with my elder brother. So she's been there for quite a while. And sometimes I say to my friends, you know, everything's impermanent, like the Buddha said, except 47 Purdon Avenue. And, you know, when I was young as a teenager, talk about impermanence, it was a structure I couldn't wait to get out of. Just chomping at the bit to have more freedom in my life and get some space from my parents. And now I go to that home, and there's such a sense, in a way, of sweetness and comfort. You know, that there's my mom, she's still alive. And at the same time, it's really meeting impermanence, because here's this woman who had a lot of agency and power, even, with me as a child. She raised me, brought me up, for better or worse. And now it's like the tables are turned, and there's so much, she has some early dementia, and so there's so much vulnerability, that when I walk in that door, it's like that she's just on that edge of being able to live on her own and not. And it's so tender. And, you know, her mind is, I mean, she can't really keep, she has short-term memory loss. So it's just this hovering with this vulnerability of aging. Keeping, allowing my heart to stay open and meet that, because there's an aspect of that that's also painful in a way. Maybe because I can't fully protect her from whatever she has to face, and that including at some point, maybe in the near future, of having to leave this home. You know, some of us have that experience with aging elders, and some of us have the experience of perhaps losing someone young, and someone's, whether they've gotten ill or been injured or hurt in an accident, you know, we don't always have that opportunity to, I'm very aware of that in my own personal life, to have this time with my mom. We don't know, really, do we? I was so touched, you know, reading some of your what you shared on your forms that you filled out, of just what, you know, what you're encountering in your lives with losses and challenges of, you know, young and old. We don't know what we're going to meet in life, and it takes strength, it takes courage to meet what's difficult. It takes courage to have an open heart in the face of sorrow. But without facing sorrow, I'm not sure we can really feel joy. I don't know what that trade-off would be if we couldn't open to our sorrow, if we couldn't feel our joy. What is life like when we're just shut down? And it's like that sometimes. So maybe we just meet that with compassion. I guess we'll go back to Joanna Macy's comment too, of, you know, I practice so I won't harm others. That here we are, we're less than 30 people in the room here, and who knows what the benefits of our practicing here together are? You know, who knows how they'll, this applying ourselves and paying attention and taking this time, how it will impact our lives, other people's lives. But here we are. And I know for myself, I just feel like our world is so in need of wisdom and compassion. So maybe even though we're in our individual minds, particularly when we're silent, you kind of feel like your mind is in a, you know, loudspeaker just with yourself. You know, maybe there's something bigger happening, much bigger happening, that that serves not just ourselves individually, but serves the world. So I think with that, I'll close with a little piece of prose from a woman named Elizabeth Tarbox. I believe she's a Christian minister. I'm not sure which tradition. It's called Rebirth. When the day is too bright or the night too dark, and your feelings are like an avalanche barreling down the mountain of events outside your control. When you look down and you are falling and you cannot see the bottom, or when your pain has eaten you and you are nothing but an empty, hungry hole, then there is an opportunity for giving. Don't stay home and cover your head with a pillow. Go outside and plant a tulip bulb in the ground. That is an act of rebirth. Sprinkle breadcrumbs for the squirrels or sunflower seeds for the birds. That is a claiming of life. And when you have done that, or if you cannot do that, go stare at a tree whose leaves are letting go for its very survival. Pick up a leaf, stare at it. It is life, has something to teach you. You are as precious as the birds or the tulips or the tree whose crenellated bark protects the insects who seek its shelter. You are an amazing, complex being with poetry in your arteries and charity layered beneath your skin. You have before you a day full of opportunities for living and giving. Do not think you know all there is to know about yourself, for you have not given enough away yet to be able to claim self-knowledge. Do you have work to do today? Then do it as if your life were hanging in the balance. Do it as fiercely as if it mattered, for it does. Do you think the world doesn't need you? Think again. You cleanse the world with your breathing. You beautify the world with your giving. You perfect the world with your thinking and acting and caring. Don't stay home and suffocate on your sorrow. Go outside and give yourself to the world's asking. So let's just take a moment to sit together. May we each meet our experience just as it is in this very moment with wisdom and compassion. And may all beings benefit from that.